This is The State of Things. I'm Anita Rao, in for Frank Stacio. Think about Mona Lisa, or Monet's water lilies. These most masterful pieces of art are required viewing for any art history student. But the weird and wacky stories behind their creation are usually left out of the textbook pages. Jennifer Dassel took a look behind the brushstrokes of some of the best well-known masterpieces and found that innovative art is sometimes the product of intense rivalries. Jennifer is an associate curator of contemporary art at the North Carolina Museum of Art and also the host of the podcast Art Curious. She'll be giving a talk about a Renaissance-era art rivalry at Quail Ridge Books next week, and she joins me now to share some of the gossip. Jennifer, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. So tell me about why you chose rivalries as a way into these really interesting moments in art history.
For me, I always say that if you tell me a good story about anything, I will completely be on board. So I always say, you know, if you're really into tape measures, if you tell me a really dramatic story about a tape measure, then I will be completely all over tape measures. And for me, I thought telling a story that has this inherent sense of drama, of, big events, big happenings, a lot of emotions, that will automatically be something of interest to most people. And so that was one of the reasons I decided to tell this story and have a whole season of podcasts about rivalries in art history. And especially because a lot of the artwork that we see, we think about it as being so beautiful or peaceful. These are the terms that we always use when we look at them and we say, wow, they're amazing. But sometimes there's a lot of darkness or backstabbing or just inherent craziness behind the method that made them come into creation.
And I think I also think about, you know, each piece of art as its own individual unit. I don't think about them often in conversation. And I feel like looking at it through rivalry sort of shows that these were made within a particular ecosystem, within a particular framework, and these people were really speaking and responding to one another.
Absolutely. You know, it was definitely not a vacuum, never really is. People are always in conversation. People are trying to outdo one another. People are mimicking one another, copycatting each other. It's very fascinating to see the differences and then similarities really that happen when people work together.
So Michelangelo and Raphael, first remind those of us who aren't art historians who they are, a little bit about their background, and then take us into the rivalry.
Yeah, they are more than Ninja Turtles. That's what I always have to tell people. They are probably two of the biggest artists of the Renaissance, working in Renaissance Italy. And at the height of the 16th century, the early part of the 16th century, both of them were under the patronage of Pope Julius II, who was really doing some massive artistic renovations to the Vatican at the time. He hired Raphael first in order to kind of spruce up his papal apartments, and Raphael did a series of murals in what are today known as the Raphael Rooms. And then a little bit after that, he hired Michelangelo to come in and do what would become the Sistine Chapel ceiling, the whole redo of the Sistine Chapel ceiling. And so those artists were both painting and working very close confines, working very nearby one another, and neither of them were completely thrilled with that. Michelangelo was a little bit older, and Raphael was this new and kind of blustery, brash, but very charming, suave artist coming in. And, the new is always a little bit distressing to somebody who's been around a little while.
So I love the role that Pope Julius plays in this, because he's sort of unintentionally setting these two men up to be in an intense rivalry, to potentially maybe try to sabotage one another. So take us into what happened.
Yes. So originally what happened was Michelangelo very early on was asked by Pope Julius to come in and create this massive tomb, which would be, you know, the long-lasting legacy to represent Julius for eternity after his death. And then partway through that process, Pope Julius kind of lost interest and was like, well, you know, I have other things that I'm really into right now. And mainly it was this series of murals that Raphael was doing. But then Julius flip-flopped again and said, well, there's another project I want done, which is this restoration of the Sistine Chapel ceiling. And Raphael and one of his cohort, an architect named Donato Bramante, came in and said, oh, we have a great idea. We have someone who you should ask to paint the ceiling. It should be Michelangelo. And the Pope said, oh, great. What a wonderful idea. I'm already working with him for this tomb project. I'll just pull him away from that and we'll do this one instead. And Michelangelo was totally worried, completely freaked out.
Because he had never done this type of art before, is that right?
Exactly. He had painted before and had done some really incredible paintings, but by no means did he consider himself a painter. He was primarily a sculptor, and that's where he felt really strong and really excited about. And especially what he was being asked to do for the Sistine Chapel ceiling was create a work of art in fresco. And fresco is this notoriously very tricky way of art where you have to be painting into wet plaster and then allow it to dry. You have to work very quickly, and it doesn't always go very well. You know, I always point to the example of Leonardo da Vinci's The Last Supper. That thing is still wonderful, and it's a masterpiece, but it hasn't held up very well in terms of conservation and restoration. It's it falls apart, and that's because fresco is not something that's totally long-lasting in a lot of situations. You have to be very careful, and Michelangelo didn't have that background, and he felt kind of sabotaged and to be thrown into this kind of project without having this basis and this technical knowledge. And Raphael and Bramante kind of did that because they really expected him to fail.
So they were gleeful expecting him to fail, but turns out he was a perfectionist and exceeded. And now the legacy is what? That we all sort of run through Raphael's rooms and love the Sistine Chapel. Is that right?
Exactly. I know. I also feel a little bit of sympathy for Raphael because his works of art in the Vatican are phenomenal and definitely, you know, in that huge canon of art history. But it is very true. We often just sort of run in order to see the big finale, which is, in most cases, the Sistine Chapel ceiling.
So you got to know about this rivalry primarily through the work of one of the famous art biographers. I think you call him sort of the granddaddy of art biography in your podcast. So tell me about that. How are you able to know whether this rivalry actually existed, or is it really through the lens of this one man, or does it matter?
That is a really good question. I would say it's a little bit tricky. So this first granddaddy of art history was one of the first artist biographers. His name was Giorgio Vasari. And in his own right, he was also an artist. So he was definitely living and working with a lot of the same people who Michelangelo and Raphael were both working with. But he was really partial to Michelangelo. They were friends. He thought very much that Michelangelo's work of art was, you know, the best. And so there is this moment where you have to kind of take that into consideration when you read his explanations and his books, and you have to know, well, he's probably a little bit biased. And so when he pits Raphael against Michelangelo and makes Raphael out to seem a little bit like the bad guy, whether or not that's true is one question, but you do have to wonder if there's some sort of innate bias going on there, just because you want to protect your friend. You want to have his back.
So another one of your episodes looks at two men who maybe were more intentionally competing with one another or pitting themselves against one another. Tell us about Jackson Pollock and William de Kooning.
Yes. So both of them were living, you know, at kind of the height at post-World War II America, where America all of a sudden became the center of the art world. All of the greatest innovations, a lot of the best art was coming up in this time. And Jackson Pollock and William de Kooning were very much at the forefront of that. And once they were introduced to one another, they were working in a lot of the same galleries. They were showing in a lot of the same spaces. And of course, their paths kept crossing as the same kind of critics were wooing them. And institutions, galleries were coming to talk with them. But they both approached modern art in a very different way. They were both working in kind of this very, you know, abstract sense, but Jackson Pollock was really moving and pushing that forward, where he was rejecting the idea of figuration in his work. But William de Kooning didn't totally do that. He did make things abstract, but there's always still this sense in his most famous series is a series of works all about women. And so you can have the sensation of looking and seeing a figure, even if it doesn't quite look like anybody we would see walking down the street. It still looks like something, a person that you can somewhat identify. And so that put them very much at odds. And Jackson Pollock once burst into William de Kooning's solo exhibition in New York and basically yelled across the crowd and said, like, you just can't get away from this,
no.
Can you? You blew it. You had this shot.
And de Kooning may have shown up at Pollock's funeral and said, I'm actually number one. Is that true?
Exactly. This is something that I don't know for sure if it's just rumor, but this is the myth of what happened. So Jackson Pollock died in the mid-50s from a car accident. And the story is that de Kooning did show up and he said, the rivalry, basically, he said, it's over. I'm number one. Simply because he lived. And Jackson Pollock had this unfortunate circumstance where he died in this car crash. And it was really interesting to see that how much that idea of rivalry really affected both of them, where, you know, who wonders if perhaps they could have been friends. Maybe they could have collaborated. Maybe they could have worked together. But they felt so differently about the directions that they wanted to take modern art that they could not help but want to try to tear each other down.
So we have this high drama rivalry, this race to abstraction, this very machismo fight for no, I'm the best. And then both of their wives sort of get roped into this rivalry as well. Tell me about them.
Completely. So both of the artists, Jackson Pollock and Willem de Kooning, both married artists in their own right who were, in some cases, especially in the case of Jackson Pollock's wife, Lee Krasner, she was actually a more accomplished artist from the get-go than he was. And at one point, they actually originally met because she hired him for a project through the Works Progress Administration, the WPA. And so she was more respected very early on. She was very reliable, and she knew everyone. And the same went for Elaine de Kooning, who eventually married William de Kooning. They were very well connected. They were completely immersed in the art world. And in some ways, they really helped to push their husbands to become the big artists that they became. But because of that, a lot of times we sort of overlook their works of art. And both of them were very accomplished. Both of them had museum exhibitions, gallery shows. And in the case of Elaine de Kooning, she was actually awarded a very prestigious commission at a time when she actually hadn't performed a lot of commissions. She was able in 1962 to do the presidential portrait of John F. Kennedy. And that was pretty big because not only was she only sort of well-known at that point, but again, she was a woman. And this is mid-century America. That was a big deal to be able to say, I'm going to have a woman do my portrait.
So both of these women were artists in their own right, created art before and after they were in relationship with these two men. Why do we still only see them through the lens of supporter and caretaker, do you think?
I think it's a couple different reasons. The first of everything is that obviously they're married to big names. And it's hard to break away when Jackson Pollock is more of a household name in terms of art than Lee Krasner. And, you know, I think a lot of people, even art history students who are still, you know, just starting out, they might automatically think that Lee Krasner is a man just because of her name. It doesn't have this automatic feminine ring to it. And part of that is because Lee Krasner specifically went by the name Lee, her given name's Lenore, because she was trying to protect herself because she knew and experienced very early on that there was this backlash against women who were moving outside of, you know, the domestic realm or the things that would be normally expected of them. So there was this sense that society at the time really wasn't as supportive to women as artists or a lot of other disciplines. And then also there's the fact that both artists really did work to support their husbands. I think that's especially true in the case of Lee Krasner, because she really acted as the caretaker of Jackson Pollock's legacy after he died. And she did a lot to really make sure that he was well known, that his work was seen after he passed, and really carry on that legacy. So that's a big job in and of itself.
Did they see themselves in competition with their husbands in the way that art history seems to view them as?
I don't think so. Not at all. There's this wonderful story. There's a fabulous quote that I ran across that Elaine de Kooning was once asked by a friend what it felt like for all these years to work under the shadow of Willem de Kooning. And she very lovingly, but I think very pointedly, just said, I didn't work in his shadow. I worked in his light. And I thought that's so beautiful because you don't have to work in competition with someone. You can work in coordination with someone. You can work in collaboration with someone. And just because you're doing similar things, you know, if you're two artists, you don't have to pit yourself against one another. You can just be together doing the same kind of thing.
And were they in relationship with one another? Were they rivals in any way, the two wives?
You know, it kind of is really funny. There's not a lot of information out there on how they interacted, but it does seem to be that they were not necessarily completely friendly with one of another because they saw that their husbands were obviously rivals. And so they resented each other's, the other husbands, because of that automatic relationship. So again, they could have been friends because they had this similar experience where they were in support of very powerful, very strong men who were big in the art world, and they were kind of shunted off to the side. They could have had this relationship where maybe they were more familial or friend-like just because they would be sharing the same kind of life experience. But that doesn't seem to have happened.
So it echoes a problem we've seen in many different fields of, you know, people either being pitted against each other by other forces or feeling like there's only room for one at the table. And hopefully now maybe there are more spaces and contemporary artists wouldn't face the same problem, do you think?
I hope not. That is always what I'm thinking. I believe, especially now with the, you know, the Me Too movement, Time's Up, all of this stuff, I think women are really getting more attention. And it has taken a long time in the art world, just like with everything else. And I do think that things are really changing and that women today as artists will have a little more attention, and not necessarily just because of who they're in contact with, who they've worked with, who they might be dating or not dating. I think there's a lot more possibility now.
I only have about 30 seconds left, but I think about your podcast as having this power to maybe reframe the stories that we have told ourselves about art history and who is important and who we should be paying attention to. How do you see your role as trying to give us a broader definition of what art history is?
Art history, I think, has this really sort of elite ideal. When people think about college, they're thinking about people who don't have to work and they just take art history classes, or it's something for, you know, Ivy League schools. But art history gives you this really broad sense. You learn a lot of things: religion, politics, interesting stories about how people relate to one another. And I think it's really fascinating. Hopefully people give it more of a chance.
Wonderful. Well, Jennifer Dassel, she is the Associate Curator of Contemporary Art at the North Carolina Museum of Art and the host of the Art Curious podcast. She will be speaking about the rivalry between Michelangelo and Raphael at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh on Tuesday, June 17th. Thanks so much, Jennifer.
Thank you for having me.
You can find out more about her podcast and everything else we talked about today at our website, stateofthings.org. The State of Things is produced by Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, Jennifer Brooklund. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Anita Rao, in for Frank Stacio.